Welcome, welcome. Yeah, there's so much music we can listen to, and it's just hard to overestimate the effect that devotional chanting can have on you. This is why it's so widespread throughout India and throughout the world. It's just wonderful and delightful to hear voices uplifted in praise in whatever culture or wherever we are. So beautiful. With that in mind, please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father,
Oh, Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Dearest Mother,
Beloved David,
Beloved David,
Saints and sages of all religions,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to you all.
I bow to you all.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles
obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my
Make my
heart thy altar.
altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my
Make
love
my love thy
thy
home.
home.
Be thou the only king reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Be thou the only king reigning on the
The
throne of my consciousness.
Peace,
Peace.
bliss.
Bliss.
Amen.
Amen.
It's delightful to see you here this evening. This is such a special time of year. You know, we've just been through the holidays, and Jill put on such a lovely program for New Year's Eve, and I can still feel the warmth of that. David Moses came over. We had a wonderful evening together listening to two of David's talks, a wonderful talk by Swami Muktananda. And it just gives you such a tremendous glow afterwards. It just makes you feel so good. And David used to talk about, you know, the hangover that you would get from being out reveling all night long, drinking alcohol and swinging from the chandelier. Can be pretty tough the next day. You know, you might have a headache, you might be a little sick to your stomach. And the hangover, the afterglow that we get from meditating all night and putting our minds on God, especially with our fellow devotees, whether it be in person together or on Zoom, you know, the entire next day you can think of that and you can feel so uplifted and feel so good. And kind of what can come along with this is this resolve, this resolution to redouble our efforts in the coming year and really put our focus on God and see where that takes us. If we're working on following God's inner direction, we can work more on that. We can listen harder. We can pay more attention. In those quiet in-between moments when we're not completely focused, we can put our minds on God. We can find that upliftment. We can find that upliftment in the tasks that we do. We can find that upliftment when we go to sleep at night, when we put our arms around your significant other and give them a kiss. You can think in your mind, you are kissing the cheek of God. You are sleeping in God's bed. You're sleeping next to God's beautiful son or daughter. And we can look at our family members in this way. We can look at the people in our lives, our friends, that this way, that they are sent to us by God. that they are our very own, and we can even look at strangers that we see on the street that way. It is such a tremendous way to go through life. So here we look forward to the coming year, and we might have this desire, this intention to grow in God, to make God a bigger part of our lives. And you know, this word intention is very, very interesting. And sometimes I'm going along minding my own business and I start hearing words being said in public by different people, and I hear this word over and over. The last 20 years or so, you know, I've heard this, do it with intention, you know, set your intention. And I always feel like there's some book that everybody else has read that was some bestseller, you know, on your psychological development that I missed. And everybody else is using these certain catchphrases and words, and I keep hearing them over and over, but I didn't get the memo. I didn't read the book. So I'm not with it, you know, and I feel like I'm a little slightly off and don't know really what's going on. And I feel like everybody else knows what's going on. They're all in on the joke, and I'm not. So, you know, I thought to myself, you know, when you come through a new year and you look forward to, or the old year passes away and you look forward to the new year, you know, sometimes we can think, you know, I'm going to make a New Year's resolution. I'm going to set my intentions higher for the coming year. I'm going to do some things. I'm going to take care of some things that I've been meaning to take care of, some progress that I've been meaning to make. I want to grow. I especially want to grow in God. How do I do that? How do I go about doing that? And so I started dwelling on this idea, and I started thinking, you know, we really want to set that intention. So I thought, you know, where did this come from in pop culture? I want to get to the root of it. I want to finally be on the inside track. I want to, you know, all the people that are hip and using the right phraseology and, you know, all this psychological self-help stuff, you know, I want to know what's going on. So I went out on the internet and I said, well, what about setting your intention? What about the power of intention? What about that conscious intent to do better? And so I made an interesting discovery, and there's a self-help guru, if you want to call him that, out there named Dr. Wayne Dyer. Now, he got a lot of publicity. He wrote a lot of books. He was had quite a following. He left the body in, I think it was 2015, but, you know, his is an interesting life to follow. And he wrote a book called The Power of Intention back in 2004. And I think this is where this term really started gaining a popular foothold in our culture, and where people are aware of this kind of work and trying to better themselves. This is where this power of intention really started entering into the common vernacular. So I decided, you know, I'm going to read a little bit about this Wayne Dyer and see where he's coming from. You know, find out if he's appropriate for us as spiritual aspirants. And so I looked into his life, and he started off as a psychologist and a counselor. If for those of you who are as old as I am, you might remember his first great bestseller, Your Erroneous Zones, and that came out in 1976. And never read the book, but I know it was a big hit. Sold lots of books and kind of put him on the map. Well, what's interesting is for about 10 years, he published books and he did talks about bettering yourself and your mindset and your attitude. And then, as often happens when people start doing these investigations and start diving deep and start doing the work themselves, that sentiment and that sort of field of study starts to shift subtly and beautifully into the spiritual. So the people I think that are really sincere and really start diving deep, I think eventually make their way over into the spiritual. And so starting around the mid-1980s, this Dr. Wayne Dyer, he shifted and he started seeking out spiritual teachers, masters. He ended up following a guru from India called Swami Muktananda. That's a title and a name that we're very familiar with because of our beloved Swami Muktananda over in India. But this was a different Swami Muktananda. This was a Swami that was born in 1908 in India when the British still ruled India, born into a wealthy family. And he devoted his life to the study of the Upanishads and the Vedas. And he became quite a well-known Swami. And he opened centers here in the United States in the 1970s, and he left the body in 1982. He was a great influence on Dr. Wayne Dyer. So, with that in mind, I want to present to you tonight a talk by Dr. Wayne Dyer on the power of intention. And he talks about three aspects and three things that a person can work on to advance. And if you're so inclined, you can certainly take notes so that you can perhaps put these concepts to work in your life. You don't have to take notes. You can just enjoy the talk. It's excellent. He does it actually in a parish church to a packed house. And it's less than an hour, so don't worry about having to stay here all night long. But it's quite a fascinating talk. And there's an approach to this talk that I want you to take. And I think this will really improve the talk for you, and it'll improve its efficacy and its effect in your life in a spiritual way. So when this Dr. Dyer is talking about these different concepts, I want you to, in each one of the concepts, I want you to overlay the pursuit of God into these concepts. And I think that'll make all the difference in this talk. And one of the concepts, to give you an example, is if there is a song in your heart, if there is still music that you want to play in this life, there is something that you've really come to do and the years go by and you haven't quite been able to do it or accomplish it yet, no matter what that might be, do not die. Do not leave this earthly plane. Do not leave this lifetime without doing that, without getting that done. So that is a perfect example of laying God over that basic idea, saying, you know, God, I want to be closer to you. I want to be with you. I want to hear your voice. I want to hear your direction. I want you to guide my life. I want you to be with me every moment of the day. There is not a moment of my consciousness where I don't want to be aware of you. Now, if this is an intention of yours, if this is something that you've wanted forever, if this is why you got on this path in the first place, is if this is an ambition of yours, if this is the music in your heart that you want to play before you leave this earthly plane, do it. Set that intention. Make this the year that becomes a reality in your life. And this Dr. Dyer, he goes over 10 separate concepts that we can do to help make intention a part of our lives, to better our lives as people. But I want to go beyond that. I don't want to just better ourselves as people. I want to better ourselves as spiritual aspirants, as sons and daughters of the divine. I want that to be in your life more powerfully than it ever has been before. So with that idea, with that notion in mind, we are going to listen to a talk by Dr. Wayne Dyer called The Power of Intention. Okay, just as soon as I figure out what I'm doing, which will be any second here.
I believe so strongly in the message of public television. I believe so strongly in the idea that we have a spiritual deficit in this country, and that we don't have an information deficit. There's plenty of that, but there's a deficit of spirit, a deficit that says there's not enough of us that feel connected to the highest and the greatest part of ourselves. And these top 10 principles that I have put together here for this program, you might want to jot down. You might want to go into your desk and just take out a little piece of paper. But I think if you practice them and look at them and see them, they come from someone who's had a burning desire, but has also been living a life in which I have felt independent of the opinions of others in terms of whether or not I should or shouldn't be doing that. There's something that I allow to consult myself within myself, rather than looking outside to see if this is right or not. And so let me just kind of, I'll number them and I'll go through them and I'll give you some examples of them. And you decide whether they're to your liking and whether they work or not. The first of these principles came from a Vedantic scholar in the 10th century. His name was Tilopa. It's not exactly bestseller books, but it's the kind of thing that really excites me, because I think of going back 1,000 years or 2,000 years and reading what some of the greatest minds had to say and how open they were to the potentiality that each and every one of us have for greatness. And this first principle says, as Tilopa put it, have a mind that is open to everything and attached to nothing. One of the central principles of my life is that no one knows enough to be a pessimist about anything. And that each and every one of us, when we close our mind to what is possible for us or what is possible for humanity, closes off the genius that resides and lives in each and every one of us. Having an open mind doesn't necessarily mean finding fault with all of the things that you've been taught by others. It means opening yourself up to the potentiality and the possibility that anything and everything is possible. So having a mind that is open to everything and attached to nothing really means finding within ourselves the ability to get rid of a trait that I find so common in the contemporary world. You know that most people that I meet spend their lives looking for occasions to be offended. They actually are out there hoping that they can find some reason to be offended. And there's no shortage of reasons. They're out there everywhere. The way this person dressed, what this person said, they turn on the TV, they hear the news, they're offended by this. Someone used language that they didn't like. Someone doesn't share the same customs as you. And people all day long, in fact, if you keep track tomorrow, you will find probably 100 reasons that you can go around being offended. But a mind that is open to everything and attached to nothing is a mind that says, I'm never looking for anything to be offended by. And that whatever anybody else out there has to say, my response to that is, that's an interesting point of view. I've never considered that before. I remember being interviewed for a morning television show, and the woman that was interviewing me said, how does it feel to be talking to audiences where people have all of these strange beliefs, these weird things that they come to? And it intrigues me, because one of the things that Emerson said is in one of his very first essays, he says, the first thing we have to say respecting what are called new views here in New England, where we are right now, is that they are not new. But the very oldest of thoughts cast into the mold of these new times And that was in 1842. He was speaking about that. And this woman asked me the question. She said, doesn't it offend you that there's people out there and they're talking about people using crystals to heal somebody? And I remember my response. My response was that if I've got hemorrhoids and somebody out there is convincing me that crystals are going to heal them, I'm ordering crystal chairs. Why not? I mean, all you have to do is understand something called a placebo. And what is a placebo? It's nothing more than a convincing belief. If I hand you this pill and say, this pill is going to cure your arthritis, and you take it, and the pill is just a sugar pill, but your arthritis disappears, I'm into buying those placebos. Where can I get some of those placebos? And it's true of everything. And it's when you think about all the things that we enjoy and what our life is like, it took people who had a mind that wasn't closed to allow us to make the progress that we've made. Progress is impossible if you always do things the way you've always done things. But the other word in this, what Talopa said, is be attached nowhere. Be attached nowhere. Attachment really means I am deluding myself into a belief that if I can't have or if I can't do this or that thing, then somehow I am going to become immobilized. So an open mind that is detached. In one of, in my most recent book, In a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem, I have an observation. And it's an observation from Anthony DeMello, a man I respect enormously, priest, who, in The Way to Love, puts it this way. Here's a great test for your relationships, especially the relationships that you're in with those whom you love, not your children, but your spouses and your lovers and so on. Try this test on for size. One, I am not really attached to you at all. I am merely deluding myself into the belief that without you, I will not be happy. And two, and here's the toughest test for non-attachment. I leave you free to be yourself, to think your thoughts, indulge your tastes, follow your inclinations, behave in ways that you decide are to your liking. How's that for a challenge? And so what most of us do in our relationships and why they are not as successful as we would like them to be is that we become attached. And we tell ourselves that this person behaves in a way that I find offensive, then I can't be happy. I make my happiness, my fulfillment dependent upon those people that I love being who I think that they should be. And detachment doesn't mean being a victim. It just simply means I know that I can make my life fulfilled and happy by having a mind that is open to everything and attached nowhere. The second principle is a very simple principle. It says you can't give away what you don't have. Now, it sounds ridiculous, okay? But it's more than what meets the ear as you hear this. You can't give away what you don't have. People who are not good at giving away love can't give away love because they don't have it to give away. If I want to give you a dozen oranges, I can't give you those dozen oranges unless I go out and pick up 12 oranges someplace. Otherwise, all it is just empty rhetoric. And the same thing is true of virtually everything in your life. You can't give away love for others if you don't have love in here to give away. If what you have in here is contempt, if what you have in here is anger, if what you have in here is fear, then these are the things you're going to be giving away in your life. And I've often thought, and I really believe very strongly that there's a law, sort of a law in the universe. I call it the law of attraction. And the law of attraction is one that works like this. You get back from the universe, from the world, what it is that you put out there in the world. And if you're putting out there into the world that I am not worthy of attracting something beautiful into my life, that the universe will respond back to you with exactly that message. And there are people who come to me and who came to me for years when I had my own counseling practice and so on. And they would say to me, I just keep attracting the same kind of people, the same kind of events, the same kind of losers into my life. Why is that? Why do I keep doing that? I keep attracting an absence of abundance. I just can't seem to attract abundance into my life. I'm always behind the eight ball. I'm never getting ahead. And I suggested to them, I said, did it ever occur to you that that's the very kind of message you're sending out to the world and out to the universe? That the ocean of abundance is there. And you can go to that ocean of abundance and you can take a Mack truck and you can fill it up 20 times a day and take it out of there. And guess what? It doesn't impact at all the ocean of abundance. It doesn't even go down a zillionth of an inch. It's unlimited. Or you can go to the same ocean of abundance with a eyedropper. And you can just take this much out once a month and say, that's all that seems to be available for me. And the interesting thing for me is that when people go to this ocean of abundance, this unlimited world, all that I have is thine, it says in the holy books. All that I have is thine. It's all there for you. But if you believe inside that it's limited, that you can only get so much, that other people are going to get it before you do, then you'll find yourself creating that very same thing. And the even more interesting part about this, you can't give away what you don't have principle, is that if your message to the universe is gimme, 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 which is a lot of people's message to the universe. I want this from you. I want that from you. Please give me this. I have to have that. That's what their prayer is like. That's what their message is. You know, and they say, I want this from the universe. Gimme, gimme, gimme. The universe's response back to that kind of a mentality is exactly the same. The universe will say right back to you over and over again, gimme, gimme, gimme. And you'll find yourself never, ever arriving, but always being in a state of striving, always feeling as if you're being neglected, never feeling as if you have enough, always feeling as if you're being shortchanged because you're constantly under the pressure to give, to get back what the universe is demanding from you. And the interesting thing about all of this, the irony of this, is that if you shift that and you say to the universe, to the world, how may I serve? How may I serve? The universe's response back to you is, how may I serve you? How may I serve you? And it's very intriguing. When you take your energy and your attention off of what you are demanding from the world, and instead saying, what can I give to the world? And it's really the basis behind that very famous line of the President John Kennedy's inaugural address. Ask not what your country can do, ask what you can do for your country. And the irony of that is, and I've learned that in my own life, that when I stopped thinking about what was in it for Wayne Dyer and how much could I get, and I began to shift and say, how can I help you? How can I give to you? What can I do for you? And people who write to me, I send them something. When I encounter somebody that needs help of some kind, I'm very often just giving that to them. And then I find that it just keeps coming back into my life. And once I shifted that energy off of what can I have into what can I give, it seemed to me that the universe responded back with the very same message. What can I give to you? And the most incredible and wonderful and beautiful abundance has flowed into my life in every way that I can possibly think of. You can't give away what you don't have. So take a look at an inventory of what you do have. How much do you love yourself? How much kindness do you have in you? How much peace do you have in you? How much joy do you have in you? And if you're able to give that away as many times as you can in a given day, watch and see how much more of that continues to show up and come back in your life. Okay? The third principle is one of my very favorites. It's called, there are no justified resentments. And this is a very difficult principle for many people to get, but one that I believe very strongly in. I was in a group one time of drug addicts and alcoholics. And I was one of the people that was a sponsor and leading this group. And the sign on the wall said, there are no justified resentments in this group. And what I said to that group that night was, no matter what anybody says to you here, no matter what kind of anger comes directed towards you, no matter how much hate you may encounter showing up in your life, there are no justified resentments. Meaning that if you carry around resentment inside of you about anything or about anyone, and I'm talking about the person that you lent money to and hasn't paid you back, I'm talking about the person in your life that you feel was abusive in your life, I'm talking about the person who walked out on you and left you for somebody else, I'm talking about all of the things that you have justified in your heart and in your life that you have the right to be resentful about. And I'm suggesting to you that those resentments will always end up harming you and creating in you a sense of despair. I've often said that no one ever dies from a snake bite. The snake bite will never kill you. You cannot be unbitten. Once you're bitten, you're bitten. But it's the venom that continues to pour through your system after the bite that will end up destroying you. So now you have to take a look at all of the resentments that you may have in your life. And I'd like to suggest to you that I think there is a wonderful metaphor for this that I have created in my life for how to make this work. And I think that Regis Philbin is the one who's responsible for it. All right? My buddy Regis. There's a show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire that has been popular all over the world. I'm in South Africa. It comes on. All right? I was in Australia, and they've got their own Australian version. And in Greece, they have the Greek edition of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And basically, this show has two levels that you have to get to. Now, the first level is the $1,000 level. And at the $1,000 level, you basically have to answer a question like, on your hand, you have some digits. Those digits on your hand are called your feet, your nose, your ears, your fingers. And everybody, whoever goes on the show, has this horrible dread that they're going to go out on one of those questions, right? So basically, in order to get to the $1,000 level, all you have to do is answer five pretty simple questions in order to get to the $1,000 level. Now, on this program, the $1,000 level for you in this metaphor means that you will leave with something if you get this. At least get this. This is the $1,000 level. You must send blame out of your life for any conditions of your life. Blame has to go. All right. Now, blame means if you're sitting there with a disease, you say without guilt, it's mine. I take responsibility for it. This means that if you have been through any tough circumstances in your life, this means if you have a minimal amount of financial security in your life, this means if your children don't get along with you, this means that if your neighbors are taking up a petition to get you out of the neighborhood, whatever it might be that's going on in your life, you name it, and everybody across this great country, across this world, has a series of these things that you're willing to say, I am here because of the choices that I have made. Right now, I'm willing to say that, even though it's difficult, and we know it's really not your fault. We know really there's a lot of people out there who are really bad, all right? But you're willing to say no blame. That's the first level, all right? That's where you understand no justified resentment. And then on the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire show, there is what is called the $32,000 level. And the $32,000 level is not only an opportunity for you to walk away with a sizable amount of goodies, which you can walk away from tonight in this program, but it also is the door opener to multi-wealth. But you got to get to this in order to have an opportunity to move into these transcendent levels, all right? Millionaire spiritual status, all right? You got to get through these next five questions. And this $32,000 question, or level rather, comes to this. It came to me from a quotation that I used in the writing of A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. I read a book that was written a couple of thousand years ago by Patanjali, the Yoga Sutras, the aphorisms of Patanjali. And one of those sutras, one of those aphorisms, observations that this brilliant man made almost 2,000 years ago was this. He said, if you become steadfast in your abstentions of thoughts of harm directed towards others, all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in your presence. Now, this translates to blame, pretty basic, no more blame. I'm just not going to assign responsibility to other people for where I am, because now I have an opportunity to get rid of it. If I think someone else caused it, then I've got to wait for somebody else to change in order for me to get rid of it. And you might wait forever for that. But if I take responsibility for it, I can do something, including move on, which might be the most important thing to do. But at the higher level, when there are no justified resentments, what you are doing is what St. Francis did, Francesco. What you are doing is you are at a place where you are sending love in response to hate. You are literally saying, no matter what comes my way, I am going to be steadfast in my abstention of thoughts of harm directed toward others. I'm going to work hard at, no matter what comes my way, having it come out of me what I want to come out of me, and that is love, and that is a higher energy. And if you can get to that level, Patanjali said, all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in your presence. I have a little girl, a precious little girl. I have six precious girls and two precious sons. But I have a little girl who is almost 12. And she loves animals like no one I've ever met in my life. I mean, her whole life revolves around animals. And when we walk in the woods, butterflies avoid me, fly away from people around, and they come and they land right on her arm. And it happens all the time. All living creatures, she couldn't have a thought of harm directed towards any living creature. And Patanjali said to us, all living creatures will cease to feel fear or enmity or anger in the presence of those who can send love in response to hate. That's what I mean when I say there are no justified resentments. What I'd like to do, I'd like to share a little story here with you. It's a very tender story. It was sent to me by someone who sends me beautiful things in the mail. And I call it the Teddy story. And I'd like to read this to you, if I can do it without tearing up. And this story illustrates this as well as anything I've ever seen. There's a story many years ago of an elementary school teacher. Her name was Mrs. Thompson. As she stood in front of her fifth grade class on the very first day of school, she told the children a lie. Like most teachers, she looked at her students and said that she loved them all the same. But that was impossible, because there in the front row, slumped in his seat, was a little boy named Teddy Stoddard. Mrs. Thompson had watched Teddy the year before and noticed that he didn't play well with the other children, that his clothes were messy, and that he constantly needed a bath. Teddy could be unpleasant. It got to the point where Mrs. Thompson would actually take delight in marking his papers with a broad red pen and making bold X's and then putting a big F at the top of his papers. At the school where Mrs. Thompson taught, she was required to review each child's past records, and she put Teddy's off until last. But when she reviewed his file, she was in for a surprise. Teddy's first grade teacher wrote, Teddy is a bright child with a ready laugh. He does his work neatly and he has good manners. He's a joy to be around. His second grade teacher wrote, Teddy's an excellent student, well-liked by his classmates, but he's troubled because his mother has a terminal illness and life at home must be a struggle. His third grade teacher wrote, his mother's death has been hard on him. He tries to do his best, but his father doesn't show much interest and his home life will soon affect him if steps aren't taken. Teddy's fourth grade teacher wrote, Teddy's withdrawn and doesn't show up much interest in school. He doesn't have many friends, and sometimes he even sleeps in class. By now, Mrs. Thompson realized the problem, and she was ashamed of herself. She felt even worse when her students brought her Christmas presents wrapped in beautiful ribbons and bright paper, except for Teddy's. His present was clumsily wrapped in his heavy brown paper that he got from the grocery bag. Mrs. Thompson took pains to open it in the middle of the other presents. Some of the children started to laugh when she found a rhinestone bracelet with some of the stones missing and a bottle that was one quarter full of perfume. But she stifled her children's laughter when she exclaimed how pretty the bracelet was, putting it on and dabbing some of the perfume on her wrist. Teddy Stoddard stayed after school that day just long enough to say, Mrs. Thompson, today you smell just like my mom used to. After the children left, she cried for at least an hour. On the very day, she quit teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic, and instead, she began to teach children. Mrs. Thompson paid particular attention to Teddy. As she worked with him and his mind seemed to come alive, the more she encouraged him, the faster he responded. By the end of the year, Teddy had become one of the smartest children in the class, and despite her lie, became one of her teacher's pets. A year later, she found a note under the door from Teddy, telling her that she was still the best teacher he ever had in his whole life. 6 years went by before she got another note from Teddy. He then wrote that he had finished high school third in his class, and she was still the best teacher he ever had in his whole life. 4 years after that, she got another letter saying that while things had been tough at times, he stayed in school and stuck with it, and would soon graduate from college with the highest of honors. He assured Mrs. Thompson that she was still the very best and favorite teacher he ever had in his whole life. Then 4 more years passed and yet another letter came. This time he explained that after he got his bachelor's degree, he decided to go a little further. The letter explained that she was still the best and favorite teacher he ever had, but now his name was a little longer. The letter was signed Theodore F. Stoddard, M.D. But the story doesn't end there. You see, there was yet another letter that spring. Teddy said he'd met this girl and was going to be married. He explained that his father had died a couple of years ago, and he was wondering if Mrs. Thompson might agree to sit in the place at the wedding that was usually reserved for the mother of the groom. Of course, Mrs. Thompson did, and guess what? She wore that bracelet, the one with the several rhinestones missing, and she made sure she was wearing the perfume that Teddy remembered his mother wearing on their last Christmas together. They hugged each other, and Dr. Stoddard whispered in Mrs. Thompson's ear, thank you so much for making me feel important and showing me that I could make a difference. Mrs. Thompson came with tears in her eyes and whispered back, Teddy, you have it all wrong. You were the one who taught me that I could make a difference. I didn't know how to teach until I met you. Isn't that a beautiful story? Yeah. That symbolizes there are no justified resentments. Work at reaching that $32,000 level, the place where the only thing you have to send is love, because that's what's inside. And that's the message of our greatest spiritual teachers. That's all they ever had to give away. The next principle I call, don't die with your music still in you. And who better to quote than Thoreau right here in Concord when he talked about some of us hear a different drummer and we must march to the music that we hear. But all of you, everybody watching, everybody here in this beautiful parish, all of you have some music playing and all of you have a heroic mission. There's no accidents in this universe. We all show up here with a purpose. There's an intelligence that is a part of everything and everyone, and all of us are connected to it. And too many of us are afraid to listen to that music and march to it. You out there, I know you have a book you wanted to write. I know there's a composition you wanted to compose. I know there's a song you want to sing someplace. Maybe you want to raise horses out in Montana. Or maybe you want to open up an ice cream shop on Cape Cod. Who knows what it may be? Maybe you just want to travel and see the world. Maybe you want to go into a relationship with someone, but you've been afraid to, but your heart says it's the right thing to do. All of us feel something. And in Leo Tolstoy's famous novel, The Death of Ivan Illich, he asks this question that would be terrifying to me. He says, as he has his accountant from Moscow lying on his deathbed, contemplating the horror of this question, what if my whole life has been wrong? I've known what my music is. It's playing right now. As I stand here in front of you with these cameras and in this place, and as I sit down and write my books and tell the world what I know are my truths, I feel always completely on purpose and fulfilled. And no time will I ever come to the end of my life and say, what if my whole life has been wrong? Whoever you are, whatever that music is, however distant it may sound, however strange, however weird others may interpret it to be, don't get to the end of your life and know that you're going to leave and not have it played yet. Don't die with your music still in you. It's the message of the greatest teachers who've ever walked among us. It's the message I give to you today as one of the principles for success and peace in your life. The next principle I call embracing silence. And embracing silence is not that I say this to you because it's so important to be quiet. What I have learned, I have a dear friend, and many of you know, we've put out tapes together. We've appeared on stages all over the world together. He's like a brother to me. His name is Dr. Deepak Chopra, medical doctor, and a dear and close friend. And whenever anything is going on in my family, if I'm having a problem with one of my children or with my in my own life, and if I call him up and I'll say, Deepak, or his wife Rita, I'll say, Deepak, what do you think I should do? He always has the same answer.
Meditate.
I'll say, yes, Deepak, I understand meditate, but I said, what do you think? He said, Wayne, go deep inside and
meditate. Always meditate.
I'll say, will you put Rita on? Wayne,
meditate.
I say, and you know, I've learned a lot in meditation. But what I know most about getting quiet and getting peaceful is this, that there's only one power in the universe, and it doesn't matter what you call it. You can call it soul, spirit, consciousness, God. You can call it Louise. You can call it anything that you want. But as Alan Watts said, you can't get wet from the word water. It's not what we call something that gives it its substance. And this one power, this one force that flows through everything and allows everything to be, is indivisible. You can't cut it in half. You can't divide it. It's one. It's knowing the one. And everything in your life is almost always given a division. Male, female, young, old, tall, short, black, white, good, bad, up, down. These are all dichotomies. These are all these splits that we all have in our lives. The whole physical world that we live in and are immersed in, it's always immersed in this division. I used to teach a course at St. John's University in New York, and I used to tell my students when I was trying to teach this principle, anybody who can come to class and bring with them a magnet that only has a North Pole, I'll give you an A in the course. You don't ever have to attend another class. And no matter how thin they would slice that magnet, there was always the South Pole, because the physical world is made up of dichotomies. But we have to learn to fuse the dichotomies. And in fusing the dichotomies and blending the want, that's what silence does for us. That's why embracing silence is so powerful. Because no matter how many times you cut silence in half, it's like zero. You still only get silence. In Zen, they say it's the space between the bars that holds the tiger. And it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. These words that are coming out of my mouth right now come out of the silence. And finding that silence and embracing it means that you go to the place within you that you cannot divide. Just like you can't divide the source, the one, the spirit. You can't divide that either. It's only one. So when you go into your silence and you begin to practice meditation and you begin to make this a part of your life and embrace silence, what you discover is this is where you'll come to know your source. You'll make conscious contact with your source. I can't tell you how many people that have come to me who have suffered from serious illnesses, who've been given diagnoses that it's terminal and that you can't do it, who have gone out to the wilderness and have decided that I am going to commune with nature. And the transcendentalists, Thoreau and Emerson, they believed that nature was our source and that we were all products of nature. And if you can get back to your source, if you can get back to that feeling of being with spirit, that's where healing can take place. And I've had wonderful stories of people who told me that it was when I began to embrace that silence that I began to feel more connected to my source. Embrace silence because it's a way to come to know God, to know your source. Both are indivisible. And the only experience you can have in your daily life that even comes close to a spiritual awakening is silence. The next principle I call giving up your personal history. And I learned it from a man named Carlos Castaneda, who once said that one day, he said, I finally realized that I no longer needed a personal history. And just like drinking, he said, I gave it up. And that and only that has made all the difference in the world. You know, the nice thing about giving up your personal history is that if you don't have a story, you don't have to live up to it. All of us have these bags of manure that we carry around with us called our past and the people who have done things to us and the events and the circumstances, all of this stuff that we use and we bond to. And we bond ourselves to these wounds of our past and we identify ourselves on the basis of these wounds. And every once in a while, we set it down and we reach in there and we smear it all over ourselves. And then we wonder, why does my life smell so bad? I don't understand this. When in fact, the now, this moment, merging yourself into the now means that you may have been in a relationship. I had a woman from Holland who came over to see me, whose husband had left her after 25 years. She had 4 children and she just had been on the verge of suicide. And she was losing weight and she was depressed and she was taking all kinds of drugs for it. And she was getting sicker and sicker because she just couldn't get over it. And she came to a book signing that I was doing at a bookstore down in Florida. And she said, you've got to say something to me. You've got to say something to me that will help me to get over this. And I told her this line. I said, give up your personal history. Merge yourself here now into this moment. And those 25 years are something, if you want to understand how to do it, think of your past as, oh, this hat. And this is your past. Now, you can't just set this thing down over here and walk away from it and give up your personal history because you'll always have it there to look back at. What you do is you pick up your past. And you embrace it. You understand it. You accept it as I had to go through these things that I had to go through in order for me to get to this place today. And the evidence for that is that I did. You don't need any more evidence. You did. And then you toss it. You toss it. You embrace it and you toss it. And you merge into the now by giving up your attachment. And some of you have heard me use the metaphor of the wake. Alan Watts talked about the wake is not what drives the boat. The wake is just a trail that is left behind. That's all it is. And so is the wake of your life. And the wake doesn't make the boat go, and neither does the wake of your life, the reason why your life is going in the direction that it is. The wake is a trail that is left behind, and it's an illusion to believe that it is the cause of your suffering or your struggles or your difficulty. Give it up. let it go. Embrace it, understand it, get help doing that if you must, and then move into the now. The next principle I call, it's from a line of Albert Einstein. He said, you can't solve a problem with the same mind that created it. In order to work at solving these things called problems in your life, you have to change your mind. It is your mind where they live. It is your mind that created them. There is where you experience them. They're all illusions. You must change your mind. Literally rewrite your agreement with reality. One of the things I had said earlier is that one of the most difficult things to do in the world is to admit that you were wrong. Admitting that you were wrong is nothing more than saying, I have been making choices with my mind that have created things in my life that are not working. And I no longer intend to continue making those choices. I was wrong. You don't have to make a declaration of it. You don't have to go out and feel guilty about it. You just simply say, it didn't work. The relationship that I was in before, I behaved in these ways. I didn't realize that it wasn't working for me. Now I do, and this is where I choose to be now. The secret of a successful relationship is, to me, understanding that you put your attention and your energy in a person on what you love rather than what you don't love. Robert Frost said it so beautifully. We love the things we love for what they are. For what they are, not for what they ought to be, not for what they used to be, but for what they are. So when you look into the eyes of a person you're in a relationship with, whether it's your children, you catch them doing things right as much as you possibly can. That's oftentimes takes a lot of hunting, but you'll find it. And when you think that my relationship isn't working, remember, it's in my mind. What am I thinking about that person? And if I could just change my mind and put my thoughts on what I love about this person and keep them there, that makes the relationship flourish. And there are people who go through their entire relationship history with no anger, no hatred, no bitterness, and only love. The next principle is, I call it treating yourself as if you already were what you would like to become. In other words, you get out in front of your life and you see yourself as having already what you know you'd like to have and deserve to have. My children know how to do this perfectly. I have a daughter who wanted a prom dress, and the prom dress was way outside the budget that I thought a prom dress should be. Well, I thought a prom dress shouldn't cost over $20, so I do have a problem. But I upped it to somewhere around $250. I don't know how much, whatever. To me, it was still more than I paid for my first house, okay? But anyway, she called and said, Dad, this is the only prom dress I could wear. I've got to wear this prom dress. If I don't wear this prom dress, it's just, and on and on and on with this wonderful. And I saw a wonderful book about how to raise teenage daughters. The title of it is Get Out of My Life, But First Drive Me and Cheryl to the Mall. All right. That's the actual title. It's a good book. And so I told Serena, I said, it's just beyond the budget. I've got a certain amount of money that I'm willing to put for it. And she said, but I've already seen myself wearing it. I've already tried it on. I have a picture of myself in the dress in my living room, and I've already showed it to the guy who was taking me to the prom. I mean, it was this whole thing about, and she already saw herself in it. I said, well, if you see yourself in it, then you're going to have to also see yourself as earning the difference between what I'm willing to pay. And she drew up a contract. She went onto the computer. And on the background of the computer, you know, where they have these little background things they put on, there was 500 pictures of the dress. All right. And she signed a contract and said, I'll babysit. I'll do this. I'll do that. And I will pay the difference. And she did. And she wore the dress because she understood that you treat yourself as if you already are what you'd like to become. There's a genius in you. You have to treat yourself as if you already were that genius. There's something you're completely capable of. See yourself as already there. Then you'll act upon those thoughts, because the ancestor to every action, said Emerson, is a thought. The next principle is called treasuring your divinity. Treasuring your divinity. There's a wonderful observation that I saw from Emerson in Self-Reliance. It's about trusting your divinity, knowing that you are connected to your source, knowing that you are a divine creation and that there are no accidents. He said, a man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within, more than the luster of the firmament of bards and sages. Yet he dismisses without notice his own thought, because it's his own. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. We often reject our thoughts, and we see the things that we think of as grand and as genius, and we reject them because they're our own, treasuring our divinity instead of being terrified of it, knowing that I am always connected to my source. There is no way that I cannot, because it is in you, and I am in you, and you are in me, and you can never be separated from me. There is no place that this source is not. It grows everybody's fingernails. It beats everybody's hearts. It digests everybody's foods. It opens all the flowers, and you're always connected to it. And finally, the last principle I call wisdom is avoiding all thoughts which weaken you. You know, every thought has an energy, just like everything else in the universe. And if you have a thought of shame, it will weaken your muscles. And what is your heart but a muscle? If you raise a child to believe in shame and feel ashamed of themselves, every time they think that shameful thought, they will be weakened. And if you have a thought of fear, and if you have a thought of stress, and you have a thought of anguish and anxiety, all of these thoughts and many more are the thoughts that will always weaken you. When you are having a thought that you know is disempowering you, shift it. Shift it to one that is empowering rather than disempowering. And the thoughts that empower are thoughts of neutrality and willingness and love, and ultimately thoughts of divinity. And when you see a troubled person who is out there struggling, at the highest level of unity consciousness or God consciousness or spiritual consciousness, you recognize yourself in all that you see. There, but for the grace of God, go I. And I am connected to that person. Changing your thoughts. I appeared on the Tonight Show many years ago, several times, quite a few times. And I remember coming home from the Tonight Show, and I was walking along the beach, and they had taped the show the night before, and I was out for a walk, and a woman who lived in the Northeast stopped me, and she said, didn't I see you last night? I mean, how could you be here? I said, I flew the red eye, and I was walking along, and she said, you know, we're moving down here. She said, what are the people like here? What's it like? And I said to her, I said, well, what are they like where you live? She said, well, she said, I live in a very big city. And she said, they're very pushy and people are not very kind and they don't have time for you. And she said, it's really not very pleasant. She said, that's one of the reasons I'm leaving there. I said, well, that's pretty much what you're going to find here. That's basically what the people are like here. On the way back on the same day, someone else who had seen me the night before on the Tonight Show, who had lived in the Midwest, stopped me and asked me almost the same question. She said, you live here? I said, yes. She said, well, my husband and I are moving here and we're looking for a school. She said, what are the people like here? What's it like here? I said, what are they like in Chicago where you live? She said, oh, she said, it's the Midwest. She said, people are very friendly. They're open. They open their homes to you. They're very loving. They're very kind. She said, it's a wonderful place. She said, I love that. I'm going to really miss that. I said, that's pretty much what you're going to find here. It's what you expect. It's what you think about that expands. It's what Emerson taught us. The ancestor to every action is a thought. Change your thoughts and you change your world. Change your expectations and you change around what you begin to manifest and see showing up in your life. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you learned something from it. And it's so wonderful sometimes to see these universal truths expressed in a way that we're not quite as used to, that aren't in the language that we're used to, but you recognize the truth behind these statements. And it's so wonderful to overlay the idea of God and the idea of being with God in any concept. And so wonderful to hear the quotes from some of these great thinkers and to take some of these ideas with us into the new year. Whatever we can do, whatever tool we can use to bring us closer to God is something that we should take advantage of. We should use anything at our disposal. And I think one of the greatest tools we have is our minds and how we think. Even though that we know ultimately we transcend the mind. We do that in meditation. We do that with great concentration on God. And once we do transcend the mind, we experience this tremendous peace, the peace that passeth all understanding. There is no greater place to be. There's no better place to be. But I love many of the things Dr. Dyer said. I love the idea of letting go of resentments, of only harboring love and goodwill towards everyone and everything. I think these are great, great sentiments. And the problem I have oftentimes is it's hard to remember to be good. It's hard to remember to think the right way. So the great shortcut for us and one of the great advantages that we have is we put our minds on God. And God takes care of it for us. We automatically start thinking the right way. We automatically exhibit more love. We automatically become more giving. We automatically see our resentments and our past dissolve in that great love that He has for us, in that great understanding that God has for us. There is no better place to be. There's no greater thing to pursue. So with great joy, we tread this path together. With that idea in mind, please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of the glorious presence of every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body.
I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light.
My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace, bliss, Amen.
Amen.
May you go through this week with your mind ever lifted in God. May God be with you at every turn. May God salve all your hurts, dissolve your pains and regrets. May God lift you up. May God make you love itself. May God be with you, bless you, until we meet again.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Peter. That was a great talk.
I agree.
Thank you. Hari Om.
Hari Om.
Hari Om.